Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Right Now Weekly Radio Show, hosted by Vicki Winterton, founder of Expert Insights Publishing, home of best-selling books, award-winning magazines, global broadcasts and communities. Right Now is a highly educational, inspiring, and empowering show focused on writing, publishing, and marketing your books, featuring outstanding guests from across the globe, including best-selling authors, world stage speakers, thought leaders, and visionaries with proven strategies, secret formulas, and treasured resources to help you succeed and make an impact. Welcome, sit back, and enjoy the show. And now your host, Vicki Winterton.
Hi, this is Vicki Winterton, and I'm so thrilled because today we have with us Gabriel Constance. Gabriel served his community since 1974 as a grief counselor, chaplain, social worker, and massage therapist, and he is certified in thought field therapy. His private counseling and consulting practice is located in Santa Cruz, California. He's a mental health consultant at the Santa Cruz Integrative Medicine and Chi Center. Gabriel also worked for the Center for Grief and Loss at Hospice of Santa Cruz County as a social worker, educator, and bereavement counselor since its founding in 1977. Additional experience includes work as a program manager for an innovative medical health center, impact and Dharma programs at California State Prisons, and as a drug and alcohol counselor for teens and ex-convicts. He has done some amazing contributing, and the most recent contribution is his new book, The Last Conception. Gabriel, welcome. I'm so excited to have you here with us.
Well, thank you, Vicki. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Well, I'd love for you to start because you've done so much in the way of contribution to others. What really started that as far as a passion and a purpose for you? What flamed that fire?
I think what really flamed that fire was when I was working in the hospital, actually, as a nursing assistant, and I saw a woman working in pastoral care who was a non-denominational minister, and she just was so connected with people, with the patients and families and other staff, and was just very present. And I think I was around 19 or 20 then, and something in me just sort of said, that's, how can I be like that? And how can I be that present for people and be that helpful? And so I went back to school and got all the degrees necessary and ended up working in the hospital as a chaplain after a while. And then all the other things went from there, but they're all essentially the same thing. Is this, how can you be the best help to somebody else so that you can get out of the way enough and be there for them so they can sort of walk with them on whatever they need to go through and not get in the way yourself. So that's how that all sort of began, and that was a while ago now.
Yes, and such a beautiful vision for our contribution to the world. Really, really beautiful. Tell me a little bit about how that work that you've been doing since the 1970s has impacted your writing and the subject matter that you write about in your books.
Well, it's impacted it greatly because there was something about when we started hospice here in Santa Cruz as one of the first in the U.S. And it was, there was something about the transition or the upcoming transition and the presence and the immediacy of it that I knew was something that would be helpful for me to be around as just a reminder to myself to remember what's important and what isn't. And about families, and I met so many different people and so many different families and so many different situations as a result of that in a variety of environments here and abroad with survivors of the genocide in Rwanda and from all different backgrounds and cultures. And there's so many differences, and yet there's so many similarities, and there are so many stories as well just heroic stories and things about people, how they could deal with what some would call the ultimate loss of death or being in the process of dying. So that's what really influenced me a lot, and it influenced a lot of my nonfiction books are about loss and grief and bereavement. One is Beyond One's Own, Healing Humanity in the Wake of Personal Tragedy, which is where I met, went and interviewed people who had started some organization or some movement as a result of somebody in their family dying in order to help other people. And some of the people are really well known that I interviewed and some aren't. And so that obviously greatly influenced that. And as far as my fictional stories, the last conception is, I think, I'm trying to remember, my fourth or fifth as far as a novel. The way it influenced that and it impacted that is I think it helped give me insight into how making people's relationships and family connections very realistic. And in the stories, and also being able to observe them as by not being in them as well, and seeing the parts that can be dramatic as far as fictional stories or not.
That's so powerful. So tell us a little bit about the storyline of the book. We don't want you to give it all away, but please share with us a little bit about the storyline.
Well, this book is The Last Conception, and it's a novel, and it's essentially the story of a embryologist who works in Silicon Valley named Savarna, and she's in a relationship with two different women, and she's not sure who she wants to really get involved in. One just wants to have a good time, and the other one wants to settle down and have children, and she's not sure she wants to have children, especially since she works every day trying to help people who'd want to have children, and she knows all that entails, and it goes through that, and her parents, the Sakans, are very conservative, originally from India, but have lived in Palo Alto most of their adult lives, and she's born and raised there. And so they don't know that she's involved with women. They keep trying to marry her off to different men that they think are good for her. And she hasn't yet told them that she's gay, and she's so that's where part of the story begins, and she has a sister, and then there's this bombshell thrown in about her parents at one point telling her she has to have a baby, and because of a reason I won't go into, but that she has to, and she's shocked because that's against everything that they believe as far as being married, or let alone her being with another woman as her partner, and so there's the very deep twist that happens in the middle of it, and then she has to deal with wondering if this is true or not throughout the rest of the story.
Wow. I love the way you refer to the story, because you really refer to it as if they are people living in your life. It's like you're talking about friends.
Well, it's interesting because in some ways they are, and as many authors, especially fiction writers, will probably have told you this many times, they sort of come to you and talk to you and tell you how they're supposed to be and what they're supposed to be like, and they'll even correct you if you're going one direction and say, no, that's not what I'm like. that I wouldn't say that. And also for this book, too, it's interesting because we have five children, three by birth and two adopted, and my oldest daughter is married to a woman named Erin, and they have two children and went through sperm donation. And my other daughter, who's married to a man, her and her husband went through IVF which is in vitro fertilization, to have both of their children. So both of those experiences from both of them and speaking with them, as well as the embryologist I went and interviewed, really come forth very deeply throughout this throughout this book and this character and the story, and that's one reason that I think it feels and sounds so real.
That's just lovely. So what do you find are some of the challenges that come to you with writing?
The challenges that come to me with writing are mostly waiting. I think that's what it calls waiting, and sitting and practicing meditation has really helped me to do that. And what I mean by that is waiting to have some perspective and letting it sit for a little bit when I've written something and coming back to it, as opposed to plow through it and then rewriting it and then having an editor look at it and then sending it off. But sort of letting it germinate and percolate and then looking at it again and perhaps changing it or not, or adding or subtracting or embellishing different parts or not. But it's really helped a lot, and that's the one thing I still work with a lot, is trying to is be patient and giving it time, and that there's no set ending when it has to be done. Unless I, you know, have a contract and the publisher wants it by a certain date, then I have to have it there. But
yeah, so how long did it take you to write The Last Conception?
Well, The Last Conception, including the researching, and took about a year to a year and a half.
So is there any particular type of process that you follow in order to write?
There is. The process I usually use is I sit and whenever I get an idea, I write it down. But then when I start actually writing the stories, I usually sit in the mornings and I write by longhand for fiction. I don't know why. Nonfiction I do fine just typing on the computer, but for fiction, I sit and write it longhand. And sometimes just sit for a while, and then something comes, and I start writing it. And then when I start writing it on the computer is when I start editing it. But that's the process I usually use, especially for fictional stories.
Interesting. And do you write every day? Do you set a time every day to write, or is it just when the mood strikes you?
When I'm in the middle of a story and I'm writing something, or I'm working on a journalistic piece or an article for a magazine, I sit and write day and evening, all day and evening, day after day until it's done.
Mm-hmm.
And then I stop and put it away and then come back to it later on. But I usually don't have any specific time. It used to be when all the kids were at home, I would have to do it when they were gone at school. But now that they're all grown up and just here off and on for visiting, I can write anytime. So
a nice luxury.
Yeah.
So how do you select your subject matter? Because with this amazing career that you've had, with so much giving and so much experience with people and people's stories at the deepest level, what makes you decide on a subject matter? Because you have such a huge, wide range to choose from, I would think.
Yeah, there is. And that's for some reason, that's always come very just innately and naturally. As far as the subject, a lot of it, especially for this story, some of it obviously came from family experiences and things, but it also from the past. In another book I did before this, a novel called Buddha's Wife, that was all about what life was like for her, with him leaving in the middle of the night after they just had their child, and he was only 2 days old after they've been trying to have children for 10 years. And then all of a sudden he leaves, and I wondered, well, everybody knows him as the Buddha and what happened after he went on his journey, but what was life like for her and what happened to her, and to have her perspective. And so that is when I started thinking. Actually, a friend in Sweden was reading a book about Mary Magdalene, and a fictional book about what life might have been like from her perspective. And he said, you should write one about Buddha's wife. And I at first didn't even remember that he had been married before, and then found out that he was, and that there was hardly anything written about her, at that time only a couple sentences. So that's where that idea came from. But most of them tend to be around women having a voice as far as fiction, and a strong voice, and complicated lives, and mixture of emotion and intellect and physicality, and that there's a lot of dynamics and not just being stereotyped or put into certain boxes, and especially women of people who have been involved with people who have been well known, but they themselves weren't as celebrated. So I don't know why that always has sort of drawn me to that subject as far as novels, but it has. So.
It's so beautiful to actually build story and storylines around those that haven't been as celebrated. And, you know, I think it's so interesting that you've chosen the woman in your stories to do this with. But if someone's just starting out writing, Gabriel, what would be maybe the top two or three tips if they're just kind of stuck? They know they have a desire to write, but they're just kind of stuck. What would you recommend for them?
Lots of chocolate. Lots
chocolate
of dark chocolate, because milk chocolate has lots of junk in it, but lots of dark chocolate. Patience and persistence. I think that's the two things. The obvious things of write, you know, the more you practice writing, the better you'll get at it. And also reading, which probably most writers will say is read a lot, and most people that write do anyway, but to keep reading other people's work, because it really influences and you really see some really good things about structure and how to tell a good story, and just being persistent in writing continually every day about anything, and keep writing. And then the other thing that's so difficult for people to do, because they get so worried about what other people think, but it can make all the difference in the world, is have somebody else read what you write and give feedback. And I don't even mean feedback as far as whether you should or shouldn't write about this or that, but about how it is coming, how it comes across, and about the grammar and the structure, and is this making sense to them? And it's usually best to find somebody that's not immediate family or friend, because many times, unless they're willing to do it very unbiased, because sometimes people will not want to hurt your feelings or things like that, but some of the most best writing and critiques I had were some of the most difficult, and yet they were the most helpful from other people. So, and it doesn't mean you always have to listen to what other people say or take it into account. It's still up to you what you want to keep or not keep, or change or not change, but just to have that different perspective makes a huge difference. And at least in my experience, has really improved my writing greatly. The editor I had, I thought this was the last conception was everything I read, I think, is the best thing I've ever written, and I wrote this. And I thought, oh, this is really good. And then the editor started working on it after it had been accepted by the publisher. And it was just so much better, the changes she made and the suggestions she made and the things that we cut out. And it was greatly improved.
Now, so tell me a little bit about how you developed relationships with your publisher or publishers.
Usually just contacting them about the story and then staying in touch with them through email and phone, and a couple publishers I've met in person and become friends with them, because other than when I had one book with Penguin Putnam a number of years ago, most publishers I've worked with are mid-sized or small publishers, and so I've had an opportunity to they've had time to be able to meet with them. With larger publishers, you can't always do that. So it's very, very one-on-one, individual. They're all very good about keeping communication open and corresponding, and that's what that's been like with them. And I really appreciate all of them. They've all had some good suggestions and ideas, and it's always been a benefit for my relationships with the publishers I'm with.
Fabulous. So tell me a little bit about what you would like to see your work and your writing, how you would like that to impact the world. If you were almost looking at it as your ideal legacy, what would that look like for you?
I don't know if it's an ideal legacy, because I'm not sure if that's possible, but I would hope that what folks would take away from my writing, as far as the nonfiction writing, is to be aware of situations and people and circumstances and stories that they may not have been aware of before, and that they can take some action or do something to be helpful for those situations. And also that the writing about death, dying, and loss, and grief, and mourning, which is really about life and living, but is that people can hopefully use some of those writings in their own lives when they are confronted with those issues in their own lives or in their family's lives, and that that's in some way helpful to them. As far as fiction, what people take away from that, I hope they find something that they resonate with in the story, something that's familiar, and also in some way it takes them to a place they may not have ever imagined going themselves, or in situations or family situations they may not have assumed or may not be as familiar with because of their own experience, and that somehow they're touched by the characters and the emotion, and see the similarity of the humanity that we all share in the stories.
Mm. Oh, that's such a beautiful vision. Really, really beautiful. So if anyone is going through, since you've done so much work in this area, integrative medicine and actually counseling people who may be going through grief and loss, what they perceive as loss. If someone's going through that, what are some of the two or three top tips that you would recommend to make their journey through that easier?
Be really gentle with yourself and compassionate with yourself as well as others. If you find yourself judging that you should be doing it a certain way, try to notice whenever you're judging. Because on top of the pain or the suffering that we may be experiencing when we are grieving, either the impending loss or somebody who's already died, a lot of times the suffering that gets added on to what we're already experiencing, the natural reaction of the pain of the loss, which is all very natural, lots of times then we're also adding on the judgment to ourselves about how we should or shouldn't be responding to that grief or that loss of, I should be over this, I shouldn't be so emotional, I should be more emotional, I shouldn't cry, I should cry more, why I shouldn't be angry, why don't I miss them? I should this, I should that, and I should have done this, or I should have done that, I should have said this, I should have said that. It seems like so often we give ourselves those messages and say those things to ourselves as a way to try to have some sense of control and to make sense of what took place, even though it doesn't change anything one way or the other. So like, we can't stop ourselves from judging ourselves or other people. But just if there's ways you can find to notice it, to try to separate that a little from the pain of the loss, and just see when you're doing that, and just notice what you're telling yourself about what you're experiencing at the moment. I think that's perhaps one of the most helpful things. And it's not easy to do. It's hard to do. It's easy to say this right now and talk about it. But when you're in the midst of it, it can be really difficult to be able to to stop and take a pause and look at what you're experiencing.
Do you recommend journaling, or do you journal yourself?
Journaling is great, and another thing actually that works, that's really helpful, I shouldn't say works for everybody, but is really helpful for many people, and a lot of cultures do this naturally. It's similar to journaling. You could do journaling during this time, but it's having a little bit of time each day for the person who has died, or for a number of people who have died. And a lot of people in many places have little altars, and they have pictures or mementos of that person. And they spend just 5-10 minutes a day, maybe 15 at the most, at the same time every day in some place that they feel safe. And during that time, they just talk to that person. And you could do that by writing in a journal also. Write whatever you're feeling about them, what you're thinking about them, mixture, angry, sad, whatever it is, telling them what's happening in your day that day. And if people do that every single day for just a short period of time, it tends to do two things. It helps you grieve the loss of them as you knew them, and also maintain a connection with them now as in a way that you want to now. So, again, it might sound very, in some ways, easy to sit and journal or to sit and do this, but it can be difficult to get in the habit of doing it. We think it's going to be really painful sometimes, but actually it's not any more painful than we're already feeling. It is, we're actually spending the intentional time to do that.
You know, that I think, Gabriel, that's such an important factor. And for me personally, I've lost all of my family and a number of friends. And at one point in my life, that happened. Everyone seemed to be leaving all at one time, and it felt like a huge loss to me. And I was mentioning this to a friend, and he said, "Why do you consider that a loss, Vicki? That really is just a change in your relationship with them." Mm-hmm. And I think the tools that you've just given us are such wonderful tools in order to progress that concept along, that they haven't really left. It's just a shift in the relationship that you have with them, the way you communicate with them. It's different.
Yeah, I really appreciate the way you said that, that it's a progression, because sometimes we tend to think, well, I'll try to get over them or forget about them or move on, as opposed, and you can't really maintain a relationship with somebody unless you also are able to grieve the loss of them as you knew them.
Hmm.
It's sort of like and we tend to do one or the other lots of times. Okay, I'll grieve and grieve and loss, and the only way I can hold on to them and stay connected is if I keep grieving them as I knew them. Or the reverse of I'll try to forget everything about them that I knew about them, and I'll just remember them how I want to. You know, and both of those tend to be just take a little more time than if you're able, allow yourself to do both, like you said, progression from one kind of relationship with them to another, by doing that by not denying the relationship as it was. In fact, fully appreciating that and all the impacts it has on you without them being there in that way. But then also finding a way of how you want to keep connected with them in the present. So,
Just such beautiful service you're in, and again contributing to the world. I really can't tell you how much I appreciate you sharing all of this wonderful wisdom and this great experience with us today. I've learned so much, and I know that those who are listening will want to connect with you and possibly be able to access the book. So I know the book is on Amazon, I believe.
Yeah, it's on Amazon, and it's also at Melange Books. That's MELANGE, Melange Books, and also on Amazon. And it's on my website, which is gogabriel.com.
So if they wanted to connect with you learn more about the work you're doing, that would be at your website, which if you could mention that again to make sure everyone gets it, that would be great.
It's gogabriel.com.
Oh, fabulous. Gabriel, thank you so much again for being with us. This is it's been wonderful spending time with you.
Oh, likewise. Thank you for the opportunity to spend this time with you, and thank you for having this venue to share all the different interactions you have with so many amazing people.
Oh, I appreciate that, and it is just my pleasure. And for everyone out there listening, if you would like to learn more about Expert Insights Publishing, our award-winning magazines, best-selling books, our global communities and broadcast, you can find us at getei.com. That's G-E-T-E-I.com. And everyone have a great week.